Okay, so let's go back to the beginning. Do you come from a hunting family? Where do you come from originally, actually?
I'm born and raised in Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay.
So still here in Phoenix. Growing up, I would go hunting with my dad from a younger age. So before I could, I guess, legally hunt big game, I would be his bird dog for dove. Typically dove. I think we maybe went on a duck hunt once, I remember. But like that was always our yearly thing. September dove hunt. If he got drawn for a deer elk tag, I would maybe tag along once I was like in sixth grade. So hunting was definitely like around our family. My dad, you know, for what we thought were a hunting family, but as I dove into marsupial gear and started, I would say like a higher end outdoor gear brand, like we were very bare bones minimum hunting family. You know, I thought we hunted a lot until I met all of our customers basically. Right. So, but definitely grew up hunting, fishing. Those were my favorite memories growing up, is spending time with my dad out in the field, fishing and basically bird hunting. And then as I was old enough to hunt big game, did a lot of that as well. As much as we could draw tags in Arizona, never hunted out of state. So our hunting opportunities, you know, if you're familiar with Arizona, it's a lottery, you get bonus point system. So we'd go maybe once a year for big game, and we didn't do a ton of scouting. It was like, hey, we went to our same area, shot first buck we saw. That was our hunting background. So I guess that's basically, you know, I was always around it. And then I always just had I played sports a lot in high school, so I didn't get a ton of time to hunt year round. But so my life revolved around sports. Once I graduated high school, started going to college, definitely started diving more into hunting and fishing with free time.
And what did you go to college for? Did it have anything to do with what you're doing now, or is it just like a general diploma?
I got a business management degree from ASU. I went with the intention to continue our family business, which was a commercial roofing business.
Okay.
I would have been like fifth generation, and did that after college. And as we were starting marsupial gear. I joke about that. I was talking about the other day. I don't know if I learned anything in my business management degree that would prepare me for what I do on a daily basis, but I did get a business management degree from ASU.
I can relate heavily having an MBA, and I think it's good to remind ourselves what those degrees are called. Mm-hmm. It's about business management. It's not about business creation, because that's what I thought I was going to school for, was like how to build business, how to be an entrepreneur. And you realize, no, it's more like you're better off suited being a director at some Fortune 500. Like that's the type of skills those types of degrees tend to give you, as opposed to the grassroots problem solving of an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
I bet you learned more being exposed to your old man with the roofing, with the roofing company.
And that's 100%. I learned more working for my dad the few years after college. Yeah, I mean, my whole life, my dad ran his business, learning from him on the day in, day out stuff and managing that 10 times more helpful than my, you know, business 101 class, whatever it was. I mean, I took some entrepreneur classes and those were good and they were case studies. And I always found those informational. And I used to love listening to podcasts too. There was one called How I Built This. That did a lot of, you know, interviews with business owners and kind of their struggles and how they overcame things like that. But yeah.
And give me a sense of time scale. How old are you now?
I'm 33.
Okay.
So we started this business in 2015. So that puts me at, I think, 25 is when I started it.
That's young.
Yeah, pretty young. So my wife and I had been married for, I think, 4 years at the time. Okay. So I've been working for my dad for a few years. Didn't love the commercial roofing space. So Arizona, obviously, summer, 115 degrees.
Crazy.
We did hot tar, you know, mop roofing, built up roofing. So it was definitely a grind. That industry was changing in general, and it was getting away from hot tar roofing, built up roofing. So my dad was looking to basically sell the business. I didn't want to continue doing that anyway. So I ended up getting as my dad sold the business, I got a business analyst job with the state of Arizona, working for DES, and right at the same time that I was starting marsupial gear. So marsupial gear started because I would go on these hunts, and I was just so frustrated with the binocular packs that were on the market. They all, you know, I want a better way to carry my binoculars. I think we all use the crooked horn harness over time, which was great. The elastic straps that comfortably carried on your chest, but they bounce around like crazy. So you had quick access to them, but they just were all over the place. And then I tried some bino packs and they were more secure in my chest, but I didn't like how they opened. And so I couldn't get to my binoculars fast, repetitively. And so I kind of wanted a hybrid of the two, where it's like, I want a pouch, but I want to be able to get to my binoculars just as quick as I could on a crooked horn harness. So I tried out Badlands. I tried out a couple other ones. And just, they all had pitfalls basically where I just wasn't happy with them. And so I was like, man, I like gear enough. I wonder if I could figure out how to make something. I wonder if I could do a prototype. And so my aunt helped me roughly. So I had a bunch of GoPro straps at the time. So I was, you know, stitching things together, stapling straps together, to kind of makeshift a harness, because I had a chest rig for, you know, that I'd use when I was fishing. And that's kind of what also stemmed Marsupial Gear. I had a fishing chest pack, I had a binocular chest pack, I carried my DSLR everywhere, I had all these different bags, but none of them worked together. So my initial thought was I wanted to make a chest rig that had, originally it was going to be a Molly panel that different pouches would go on, and we quickly got rid of that with just four buckles interchanging them. But so my thought was one platform, different bags would go on and off depending on what you're doing, because I kind of was like a jack of all trades, master of none. Love to fish, love to hunt, love to take pictures. And so I was always constantly doing different things, and I wanted one system that would work together with one harness that worked really well. So my aunt helped me make a crude prototype, and then I just basically started looking online for, I went to a sewing store here in Phoenix, and they, all the ladies in there were quilting and looked at me like I was crazy when I wanted to make like a, you know, a bag and pouch. And so quickly wrote that off. And happened to come across this horrible website online that was like a contract sewing facility. I found them, they called them, booked a meeting with them, and they helped me basically do my first few iterations of prototyping. So
now, quick question to jump in here, because this is where a lot of people start to get really interested. Yeah. Did you have to, and I've been lucky enough to work on a couple prototypes. Sometimes they're willing to do it on spec. Sometimes you got to have some type of volume agreement in place. Like, were you just lucky that found somebody that like saw the potential, so they're willing to help you work on the prototype without, like, how did that initial engagement start? And did you have to make any type of commitment to get them to help you get to like a production quality pack?
Yes. So I got a few things. I got very lucky in the fact that the gentleman that I met with at that contract sewing facility was the new GM as of like 1 to 2 weeks. They had pretty much paused all prototyping before him. And once he started, I think he said I was the first call about basically a new prototype. And so he was like, sure, come in for a meeting. So I go in and I walk in there, and they give me a quick little tour, and I walk through the production doors. And it's like, they're sewing Mystery Ranch backpacks. They're sewing Loophole scope covers. They're sewing all these Swarovski scope covers, all these brands that I recognize. They're doing all sorts of other crazy things. And I was like, holy crap, like, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And I was under the assumption that everybody made their own stuff in-house. Like, I just like, oh, everybody's got a building, they make their own stuff. And even the Made in USA brands, I thought, oh yeah, of course, everybody makes their own stuff in-house, which I've learned over the course of starting this business. Very few people actually make it in-house, which there's nothing wrong with that, but there's a lot of contract sewing facilities throughout the United States that make all this gear. So I walk in there, I have a meeting with their GM and their lead prototyper. I basically give them my rough sketches. Here's what I want to make. Here's my idea. They look at it, and then we sign an agreement. I think it was like $1,500 a prototype to design and for them to do multiple, I think three iterations of it. There was a cap. And so we started with our binocular chest pack, our fishing chest pack, and a rangefinder pouch. Those are our three products that we started with, that I paid for to have developed.
And was being made in USA always like an ethical decision, or was it more of a practical decision?
I think
my cat's freaking out.
Oh, you're fine.
Was it more of an ethical thing, or was it more of a practical thing? Because it can actually be very difficult to do that type of prototyping back and forth overseas, and like driving down the road and just talking to guys is way easier.
In the capital. So I would say both. I definitely the location and proximity of being able to do it right in Phoenix was massive. I mean, because how otherwise I'm, you know, you're emailing, who knows, where do you even go to get a prototype made that's overseas? And I could probably navigate that a lot faster nowadays. But back then, I mean, without having any background, no idea. So the fact that they were in Phoenix and I could drive to them and actually go over prototypes with them was huge. But more importantly, I think one of the other reasons I was so sick of having stuff that fell apart and that was made crappy and with no warranty and all that, I really wanted it to be made in the USA too. So that was big for me because I really wanted high quality stuff to be made. Because that was not only, you know, functionality was huge, but then the quality. And I think we've all seen the hunting industry. There's a huge spectrum of the quality of products that people buy. And so I really wanted durable gear that would last. And I was especially walking through those doors and seeing everybody making the gear right there. That was like the biggest light bulb moment for me. It was like, I definitely want to do this and I want to make it like right here. So that sparked my, the onset of marsupial gear. We already had the name and everything in my head. And I actually spent the next year and a half trying to get hired by that contract sewing facility. Because I knew instantly that's what I wanted to do.
Okay.
And so, fast forward, went through prototyping, got our first production run. I think the minimum that they had to do was 100 units. So we did 100 binocular packs, 100 range finders, 100 fishing packs. That was also in the contract of, hey, we're going to prototype it. And then I'm responsible for 100 units after the fact, which now, having gone deep down this rabbit hole, isn't really not a lot of units.
I'm kind of shocked, man. Like, we're talking like somewhere in the neighborhood of, I don't know, 15K north or south. Like, that's an insurmountable finance.
No. And so to start everything, we put $20,000 of our own money into it to get the ball rolling. And that was spread out over about the course of a year with prototyping fees. And then it was my responsibility to source the fabric. And then, so I learned from scratch with that. And then the production of those 300 units, I think it was all in, with website and everything that we did was about 20 grand that we invested of our own money, which was a ton of money for us. To do that and to gamble on.
Yeah, 100% it is, man. Now, can you talk a little bit about some of those sourcing challenges? Like, I feel like it's a bit of a stroke of luck you find the sewing facility. But like, when it comes to these industrial level suppliers and stuff, it's not like, I mean, with the internet, the information is there, but there's not some like magic phone book you just open and it's like suppliers are us. Like, what does that process actually look like? And did you have any scale volume hurdles there that you also had to jump through to get yourself to decent pricing?
Oh, definitely. So with that contract sewing manufacturer, they helped me with a couple phone, like, hey, we get buckles from here, we get fabric from here. So that's kind of, I went with them on that. And luckily I got good suggestions from them from the beginning. And I still have, say, not lifelong, but my initial contact for buckles, which I basically cold called because they gave me three different places to get buckles from. I got a hold of one guy and he's my supplier for all our plastic hardware because I knew I wanted a certain type of buckle also.
Buckles are such a big deal, man. And I don't know if people, I was running a prototype exo pack and they were trying to experiment with some new buckles. And it was amazing how heavily it impacted the user experience. And they ended up switching back to the old buckles. Super glad that they did. But it's like, because you're interfacing with it so often, it's like such a main touch point of the product that like a poor buckle, it just kills the user experience for the entire
product.
And it
blows my mind how many companies will cheap out on a plastic hardware.
Yeah.
And it will ruin, like you said, the entire experience.
Yep.
Pack. And it's like,
it makes it feel like a piece of junk. I don't care if the rest of it is off the charts nice. Crappy hardware, it kills it for me.
Yeah. And it's like, our female buckles on our binocular packs, I think they're like 25 cents a piece, which sounds like it's nothing, but you can go get inferior female buckles for like 5 cents a piece. So I think some of these companies, especially when they're making them overseas and like pennies really matter to me, I'm like, oh my gosh. An extra 20 cents a buckle, no brainer, put the better things on there. Like you can slam your truck door on a female buckle that we use and you'll probably dent your door before you crack the buckle. And that's what I wanted because I've had things break and it just sucks. It ruins your hunt. It can literally ruin your hunt.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to put the best quality components on it. So when I first met the guy I buy all my buckles from, I was like, hey, I needed 400 buckles because we're making 100 packs. And so he was like, the case, per case, it's, 1,000. But he, for whatever reason, took a chance. He gets cold calls all the time with me, sold me half a box or whatever it was, which he's got to go out into his warehouse, break open a box. And he was kind enough to do that. And so I got all the hardware from them. And then fabric, they introduced me to somebody at a fabric manufacturer and they had cryptic camo and I could use theirs without getting a license fee for it. So we did our first production runs in those colors. And so it just kind of was, I just started chasing leads and if they didn't have it, I would say, well, do you know who does, and they would maybe be kind enough to give me a lead. And then I called a lot of people and then it started getting sample swatches sent to me. Cause a lot of them will send out samples once you find these places. But really, it was a lot of trial and error and a lot of talking to people to get just a little bit of a lead, to do some digging, and to call them. And then I think that was after we started. We went to SHOT Show, and there is a place at SHOT Show where you can go and talk to a lot of vendors as well.
Okay.
And that would speed up a process for sure.
Right.
Yeah, starting from scratch now, I can definitely start and to finish a cut and sew shop or a brand 20 times faster than what I had to kind of sift through and learn on our own just by figuring things out. Because I didn't have anybody who really showed us how to do it.
No, and even going back into 2015, there was like, I can name 10 textile manufacturers, not like Marsupial, but of that brand that have popped up since then. And I think there's a lot more. I also think that like the global manufacturing has got a lot smoother. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, probably unfortunately, because of kind of some of the rebranding issues that I'm currently kind of dealing with and realizing are happening, and some of the products that you think are, you know, unique products are not. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're just rebranded Alibaba garbage.
Yeah, that's a whole nother.
Oh my God, man. I'm diving down this rabbit hole lately. And
yeah,
it's like,
I saw something that you posted on that, and I'm like a bit of a flashlight nerd. I mean, I carry a nice flashlight in my pocket, and I know exactly what you're talking about. And that's a whole nother can of worms.
And as soon as I started making that, like the posts, like the DMs just started flooding in. It's like, oh, you like that? Check out this. You like that? Check out this. And you're just like, it shakes your confidence in the whole industry. It's like half these guys aren't making anything. And I don't even care where you get it made. I mean, as a business strategist, I think there's an argument for global manufacturing. Oh, I don't 100%. Think everything has to be made at home. What I have an ethical problem with is taking a product that's made for $10 or $20 overseas already and like making one or two tweaks to it and then selling it onshore for $100. It's like, guys, this is not
the best thing. It's revolutionary.
Like, let's just be honest with it. Maybe charge a 40% markup and you got yourself an okay product, but this song and dance that we've created, the best thing since sliced bread. And it's like clearly just rebranded kind of low end Chinese junk. Anyways, I don't want to get negative and go down that rabbit hole. Okay. So we got our prototypes done. We've got 100 products. Now, how are we actually finding a market for these products? Where does the actual, like, now I need people to buy these things? Where's that? How do we solve that problem?
Instagram was how we started.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and then that was when Instagram was different. Instagram's a lot different now than it was in 2015. So, I mean, I remember sitting at my friend's house, who he owned a marketing business at the time. So he was kind of always my inspiration. He was my age. He was 24 and he already had a marketing business with, you know, 15 employees. And so, I bought the URL for Marsupial, or the domain for marsupialgear.com, got the Instagram login, all that. And so basically just started trying to promote it through my small network of friends that I have personally. I'm like, hey, new hunting gear. And that's when the hashtags actually worked at the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, stuff would pop up if you followed hunting. And so we just slowly started like teasing, hey, we're coming out with some new things. And then people would kind of reshare it, but it was all organic through social media.
Okay.
I think when we launched it, I don't know, my wife and I were just talking about this. I think it was maybe like a week before we even sold one.
So you're just shitting. You're like, oh my God, just convinced my wife to drop 20K. No one's buying
we're
this stuff.
25 years old. We don't have.
I'm an idiot.
Yeah. You know, and luckily or unfortunately for me, she's super supportive and believed in me. And so we did that, and I'm laying in bed.
And do you guys have kids yet at this point?
We did not. No kids at that point.
Okay, great. So, perfect.
Yeah. All the time in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I miss those days, man.
I also did forget, which my wife would point out, that I also had the credit card portion turned off on the website for like a couple of days. So like even friends who wanted to buy a hat couldn't even buy a hat. And so that was just complete ignorance on my end. So I built the Shopify store by myself.
Okay.
And it was just all word of mouth. And so, you know, we sold one on through our website. I remember driving home from a fishing trip and it was like 8 o'clock at night or something. And it was like, I got a notification. It's like, holy crap, we sold one. And it's like, is this real? Is this fake? And so that kind of was like, all right, this is a thing. So I don't know, they slowly started coming in, and it got to the point where we worked through our first 100, and I would meet people a lot in parking lots. I don't know how.
So you're doing all your shipping. You're not using any type of drop shipping. Okay. You don't have any kind of.
We brought home four boxes third party. Gear. It went into our spare bedroom, and we're like, all right, we got to sell it. And so I had no idea where I have to source boxes from, tape, all that stuff. And so I just started looking at other brands that I like and tried to emulate things that they did well. So I got branded packaging tape. Tried to, you know, got a header card. I would write a thank you note to every single person that placed an order. Tried to, you know, throw my business card in there with my cell phone. And so we would package up everything. So basically went through those first 100 units of each thing, did another production run, then made 200 of each. And kind of that was our philosophy.
And you're essentially using the profits from the first section to let, you're just flipping cash at this point.
Yep. We both have our full-time jobs. That's our income. This is all side hustle. My goal was, hey, can I
make it? So here's another quick interrupt, because I don't think people understand, because they always want to know, how soon do you make it your full-time job? And I think a more important question is, what type of time commitment did this take outside of your full-time job in order to actually get this thing off the ground, realistically?
I'm looking at my wife right now. She's in the office with me, and I'm smirking because we both... Like, it's our life. It's been our life for the past 8 years. It's consumed our life. It has consumed our life. We had no life. So every evening, especially as we started to grow, and it's like, got ship orders every day. Everybody expects their packages to get to them Amazon speed. So you can't just let them sit there for a few days. So, and if we're not shipping packages at night, we're answering emails. Or I'm working on the website, whatever it is. You know, Marsupial Gear started once my full-time job ended. So And that's the one thing. I mean, there's 24 hours in a day. You can get a lot done in a day. And that's always my suggestion to people too, where they're like, oh, how soon can you quit your job? And I would almost flip it around. How long can you juggle two jobs before you quit your full-time job? So it's not a giant leap of faith. It's more of like a gradual step, because you got a full-fledged business that you've been doing after hours. And I would say it's not for the faint of heart, not that I'm tooting our horn, but like, that's literally what we did. We didn't go on vacations. We didn't do the fun stuff our friends were doing. We poured 20 grand of marsupial gear, you know, of our personal money into marsupial gear, and then kept dumping it back into it and back into it. And so we didn't have the extra money to be going doing fun things like our friends who were traveling to other countries, or, and nothing that's wrong with it, but that's just what we chose, you know, to spend all our time on.
I want to highlight that insight, because I think the way you rephrase that, it is the perfect way to do it. People ask the question, how soon can I quit my job? And I think the question needs to be, well, how long can you keep it? Like, do you get to the point where the other business is so flourishing that you just simply don't have enough time for the full-time job? That's the way people should be looking at
100% what we did. And I mean, there's obviously a bunch of different strategies for starting a business, but we 100% bootstrapped this business from the ground up. We did not take a penny of outside money to do it. So I had to work a full-time job. And then I'm always a pessimist, where it's like, well, what if this doesn't work? I need to have the security of a full-time job. So I was working for the state. My wife worked for mortgage industry. And so we both did that all day. We came home, eat dinner, do whatever, but then we would pack and ship and answer emails. And that's obviously that has grown over time with the volume of what that required, but it was what we did every day for the most part. Every day.
So when does staffing become an issue? When do we get to a point, who's the first person you bring on, and what do you need to be done that you get them brought on for?
So to segue real quick. So the biggest blessing and the big, you know, what was the biggest curse that turned into a blessing was so my contract manufacturer that I was using to sew gear, after my second production run, I was starting my third, I think it was just right before my third finish, they went out of business. So they're owned by a large company. Yeah, exactly. What was my words? So I was trying to get hired by them for about a year and a half. They're owned by a large company in California who does contract. So basically they decided it wasn't worth their time to have the smaller one in Arizona.
Okay.
So they close Arizona. I got nowhere to go. I'm way too small of a fish for them to even waste their time with, along with a bunch of other companies. But now here's this contract sew company that I was trying to work for, and I have nowhere to get it made because they've ceased to exist. I met another guy in the process of this who had the capital to start a contract sew business, and I had the desire and passion to run it. and we kind of joined forces. So we actually picked up the pieces where that one left off. We hired 10 people who are now looking for a job. We called the 20 other companies who were like me, small, and needed their stuff being made. So we basically picked up where they left off.
Okay.
So that was huge for me. So that's when I quit working for.
And you buy the space, you buy the gear, you buy everything, like keys to the front door or what? Or
no. So basically the guy I worked for, we went and found a building. We leased it for 5 years, hired the employees, and then started buying all the material and basically started. I ran a contract sew shop for 2.5 years and then once again, doing, like I said, work your full-time job until you can make it your, you know, your part-time job becomes your full-time job. So, but what I was lucky in the sense is that we took a really crappy situation, started a contract sew business. And then I got to oversee and run that for 2.5 years before I decided I need to stop sewing for 20 people. We need to sew our own stuff full-time. But there was a limbo period of quite a few months where I befriended the sewers in the sewing facility. I would drive across town, get a cut at the one guy's house. I would drive it to who is now my production manager here in her house. She would sew it in her house. She could make 40 packs a week. And that was what we did. And she would trace and cut things out on her living room floor. And I would just drive around town to get things made.
Wild.
So that's what I would have to do until
it's like a decentralized sew shop.
Oh yeah. And that's and that's also another business model that people do use in this industry as well, which is interesting. But, so I did that for like 6 months before we got the other contract sew shop running, ran that for 2.5 years. And then eventually said, Marsupial's growing too much. I don't have the time to manage all these other businesses. I want to just do Marsupial Gear full time.
What a fast track of experience though. Like you, if it had only been making marsupial stuff, you would have been limited to being exposed to X amount of products and X amounts of problems. By taking on those 20 clients, by running that sew shop, you got 15 years worth of, you know, contract sew experience crushed down into two.
So that was a blessing. What, you know, it could have been a curse. I got to see where other companies got stuff from. I got to meet more vendors. I got to meet other companies. And we sewed everything from the medical field to tactical to you name it. We sewed soccer balls for horses. I mean, all sorts of random things, but everybody's got to get stuff made somewhere. So, but I got to learn all those things. And not only that, our employees had years and years of experience of sewing. So I learned a ton from them. And I basically, like you said, I took a huge amount of time and condensed it into 2.5 years of running that contract sew shop. And was able to fast track Marsupial's growth because of that. Because if I was just sitting at home getting my stuff made by a contract sewer still, I never could be exposed to that much.
No, that's wild, man. Okay, so let's talk about the kind of innovation timeline of Marsupial. You guys technically the first front opening vinyl case?
Not 100% front opening because Badlands opened this way.
Right.
I don't know if you can see me on the video, right? But Badlands opened forward, but it was like a clamshell. So it opened, but then it would snap shut.
Yep.
And so, and then Kuyu had their first iteration and it would kind of half fold down. So I guess you could say that was forward opening as well, but no one had a lid that opened all the way and then came around and stayed open from my research. And maybe I'm missing an obscure one, but none of the heavy hitters were making a forward opening vinyl pack. And so I wanted a lid, and there was quite a few that opened forward, but then as soon as you pulled your binoculars out, they would cover the opening. I couldn't stand that. I wanted basically an open pouch that I could drop my binoculars in and out of. Elastic Guide Creation, awesome pack. You open the lid, it covered right back open. FHF, great pack. You open the lid, it closed right back open. Badlands.
Until maybe a recent iteration, which we can talk about later.
Yeah. And so then Badlands opened like a clamshell. It was great. Tons of protection, but it would slam shut and it would make a loud noise. Kuyu, theirs opened nicely, but then their harness was disconnected from the pouch. So when you pulled your binders out, the pouch would fall down. And that was before their new one that came out that they still run now. But I had not found one that would open forward, stay open, and have an open bucket to drop your binoculars in and out of. So I'm going to say that we pioneered that. It's very common now, but no one was doing that.
Yeah. Okay, so, and now take me along the product list. Like, where we have the first Bino pouch, and then we kind of have a 3-year period where the contract sow for a bit, then you take over the contract sow before you're big enough for marsupial to require its own dedicated sow facility. What's the product innovation timeline look like across those 3 years, and what kind of product SKUs are we looking at by the time marsupial gets its own contract or its own sow facility?
So over the course of those years, I was squeezing my prototypes in between other prototypes. And I had that worked out with the owner, because it's like, I was developing new products and I was guaranteeing us orders. So, I mean, I would pay just like any other customer that we were sewing for. I would pay to get my stuff made. It would happen to be on the production floor, just like any other company. I would source all my own material still and handle all that. And then I would take it home instead of a customer picking it up and driving away with it. I would take it home and my wife and I would pack and ship at night. So none of the fulfillment, that all was after hours still. And during those 2.5 years of us running the contract sew shop, I came out with more accessory pouches for the chest rig. So we had a small zipper pouch, our radio pouch. I think we did bear spray over there. And then we came out with our BTX case. That's when the BTX 95 first came out. And right. So we always try to solve problems is my goal with coming out with new products. It's like, I don't want to just put our logo on anything and everything. We want to try to identify a problem and either improve upon what's out there or solve that problem for what we find with pitfalls of other products. And so knowing that the BTX 95 was huge at the time, no one had it, no one had a way to protect it. So we got one of my buddies who had one brought it in, and we prototyped that. And that was the start of our spotting scope cases. So I thought we were just going to do a BTX 95. Then we had a ton of people asking us for, what about my straight? What about my angle? So then we made a whole spotting scope product line. So we had that by the time we moved.
Okay, quick pause there. Because I think there's a really important point you made about recognizing problems that needed to be solved. And I always like pain pill as opposed to a vitamin. Like, if you're going to sell anything, I want to sell something people need, not something people want.
Right.
What types of insights or gut reactions or what are you paying attention to, or what makes you aware of the fact that there is a problem that needs to be solved in the first place? You hear people talking, you see a new product. What's your mind kind of space like that leads you to the conclusion that, oh, there's an interesting problem here that I think we have a unique ability to solve?
I think I've always just kept a pretty close pulse on the industry as a whole. I've always been a gear nerd. I've always been intrigued by products like that. I used to spend a ton of time on forums, Rock Slide. There's one in Arizona called kuzwhitetail.com that was big at the time. So I used to spend a lot of time on there and read product reviews. I've watched product reviews. I'm a big product user myself. So I would find things that I like, and then there would be things I didn't like about it. I'm not saying I'm the expert, but that a lot of it has been my personal frustrations with gear that I wanted to improve upon. And mine is not a one size fits all for everybody, because going back to the Bino harness, Alaska Creation makes a great pack, but for me, it was too big.
Right.
So then I wanted to make a slim down pack, but then there's guys who wouldn't want a slim down pack. They'd want the Alaska Guide Creation with everything right there. So it was me, a lot of personal use frustrations and not being able to find things that would solve them, that would do that. And then some of them are as simple as like a radio pouch. I wanted a way to carry my radio on my Bino pack. You know, there's a million radio pouches out there, but we wanted one to interface with our pack really well. So that's why we made that. You know, a new product comes out, there's no way to carry it and protect it. Let's make something that would protect it. So basically just kind of solving those problems that I had come across in the field personally, or as we got more involved in the hunting industry, a lot of people would say, hey, I wish you could solve this problem, or if you could build a pouch for this, things like that. And we do get a lot of feedback from our customers in our user base, and we listen to everything. I mean, we get a million ideas pitched to us all the time, but I start to hear, you know, I have a pretty good memory on certain things. And it's like, if I hear the same thing over and over again, I'm going to, you know, invest some time and energy into it. And basically just a lot of research, I would say, and seeing what's out there and seeing if it's viable to even make a new product. Because there's a lot of expenses that go into developing a new product. And that's where I think people don't understand that, of how much really goes into each product.
I would think too that 2.5 years at the contract sew facility would give you an idea to do like a really accurate business cost analysis of a new product. Like, what's it going to cost me to prototype this and then get it to scalable level of production? And is people's willingness to pay going to exceed my production costs? Whereas that might take a long time and there would not be nearly as much confidence in the number somebody else might be able to come up with.
Exactly. And two, it's, you know, what does it, where do we need to be? And then what will the market actually dictate? What will the market actually allow us to sell it for? Right. And there's, that's the tough thing. And no product's the same. We always have a certain multiplier we try to hit, but there's certain products you're never gonna be able to hit that for. And so, and then right now we're diving into the archery industry. And that is interesting to me too, because we are trying to teach people too. Like, people have been so plagued, all the archery accessories for years and years and years have been made overseas for pennies. Yeah. And it's all crap, in my opinion, as far as construction quality goes.
Yep.
And what's funny is, like, we came out with our simple bow case. It costs a lot to make it. We charge $300 because that is the feasible time it takes for us to sew. There's a lot of labor involved. There's a ton of material in it. And that's what it costs. And people are like, oh my gosh, I want to buy that. I could buy that a case like that on $29 on Amazon. It's like, first of all, you can't, because the components are garbage. It's apples and oranges. But then it's crazy to think that people are conditioned, like, that's what a bow case should cost. And when you look at it and it's like, look how much material is in it. Look how much time and labor someone had to actually sit behind a machine, sew that, send it across the ocean. Someone's buying it here and still making money on that $29 bow case.
Yeah.
Someone sat in a machine and sewed that. And I'm really cognizant of it now because I see how long it takes to make everything. And it's like, whether it's made here, it's over there, our operators are just as good. Yeah. And they're sitting behind the machine the same time that they are, but they're just making pennies. And so when you start seeing that, it's like, holy crap. And it's interesting too, because like you said, you did that big backpack review. People really don't blink an eye. I mean, they do, at spending a lot of money on a backpack.
They'll just look at a Kafaru, and like I ran Kafaru for years. I love it. But you're talking, like, by the time you put all the bells and whistles in that thing, you're like $1,200, $1,300, man.
Exactly.
And like, people do not bat an eye.
No. And, but yet they're taking their $2,000 bow and putting it in a $30 soft case and be like, this is great. And so it's like, when we start sewing these bow cases, like, it's almost like a backpack. And I don't think we'll ever get into the big pack frame market, cause I think it's so saturated and there are lots of good pack frames out there. What are we going to do? What problem are we going to solve? You know, I'm not trying to attack that, but it's just like, it's crazy to me how people are conditioned to pay a certain amount for certain products. So I always look at that. What is the market willing to pay? What is our actual cost? Is there a happy medium for us to make money in it? And, you know, like, we've been getting hounded to make Big Eyes cases, which I don't know if you follow those at all, but they take two spotters, put them together.
It's
big in Arizona, big in, and it's like, there's probably only a couple hundred of them floating around there. You know, it's going to cost me at least $5,000 to start a new product. By the time prototyping and everything that we put into it, how many of them am I going to sell? Is it worth doing? I'd love to make anything and everything. We just can't make money on it. So, but people ask us to sew custom gear all the time. And it's just not, I always kind of nicely say, you wouldn't want to pay what I'd have to charge you to do it, because I have to have my lead prototyper stop what he's doing, sit in there, draw from scratch. It's not as quick and painless as people would think. So there's a lot that goes into.
No, I think the product selection is really interesting. And what also I find very interesting is the life cycle of the brand itself. Like, if you'd have tried to drop the bow case 5 years ago, I would argue it would have tanked because you didn't have the brand credibility to retrain these people. 100%. But like, Marsupial's been around long enough. It's built up enough street cred now that you can have that conversation. And to be honest, there's a segment of your population that's of your demo that's just going to buy whatever you put out because they're like diehard Marsupial. And that's going to be, those early adopters are going to give you enough traction to like get that. But if you hadn't have built the brand the way you did, those people wouldn't even exist in your demo, and that wouldn't option.
If we sell a good amount of spotting scope cases each year, if I started a business just selling spotting scope cases, it would be a dud. I mean, it wouldn't have worked. And there's lots of products that we would have came out with that have not, we couldn't have done unless we, like you said, had gotten our credibility with the bino packs. And so that is built upon it. And I mean, and that's one of the things that we're trying to do. I want to do an overview video one day of just like, here's what you're getting when you buy our bow case versus, and we're making another version too, like a really deluxe deep dive. Like I joke, I want to make the Yeti of soft bow cases, and people think I'm crazy, but it's like, people also thought Yeti.
That's
was
a
crazy.
Great example, man. Cause you know, I can go Canadian Tire. Obviously I live in Canada and I can buy a Coleman cooler for $49.99, but I've got a $700 Yeti sitting in the shed. And when I pack up the truck to go sheep hunting, I don't put the Coleman in the back of the truck.
Right. And so that's where it's like, you know, we don't need to sell one to everybody, but people, if they want to buy the best of the best, we want to make it for that market. And that's kind of been our goal as we kind of continue to grow too. And so, and we offer a lifetime warranty on everything that we make, like 100%. And so that's what I also try to hammer home is like, if you break something on our pack, we will fix it. I mean, you see our videos, I have a whole team out there sewing. Not only are we made in the US, but we're made in-house. And so I can fix things. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, I got a pack back from our first 100 packs because I could tell different differences of not first 100. And we fixed it. Wild. We sent it back to the guy. That's 8 years old.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? 7, 8 years. It's crazy. But we
fabric product.
Yeah. And it's a zipper. A zipper broke. And like zippers do fail over time. But guess what? We can fix it.
Yeah.
And so that's what's cool. I mean, like, you know, go buy some other product that where you can go do that, send something in 7 years later. Most of the time, there's very few brands that can do that. And so that's the additional added value that you're buying gear that's going to be around for a long time and is serviceable and repairable if you do abuse it. My favorite thing to do is get a pack back that is disgusting. I mean, it's gross and I got to clean it before I can hand it to our sewers. But like when you see guys who have been absolutely using the crap out of your Bino pack, to me, that's so much more satisfying than someone who's quote unquote famous on social media using it, you know, and it's spotless. Like, I love seeing when our guides and outfitters in Arizona, especially, are just abusing the hell out of the packs, and they look disgusting, but they're like, I love this pack. It's my favorite pack. I've been using it for 6 years, and it's not broken. So that's kind of where we take a lot of pride in everything that we make.
Okay, I got a ton more questions, but I also there's some big macro topics I don't want to gloss over, and I'm cognizant of the time that we're at. Yeah. I'd like to discuss some of the leadership struggles because I think coming up with a good idea and getting to a product to market is one problem that requires one skill set. Scaling a company and building a team that's capable of running long-term is another skill set. This is why you see a lot of founders don't turn into CEOs because the two skill sets tend to be somewhat disparate.
Right.
But here you are, you founded, you innovated, you created, and you've scaled. So what was that second round of challenges like for you as far as, okay, now we're big enough. I need to build a team. I need to manage that team. I need to delegate. I need to be able to trust. What was that journey like?
That's been really difficult if I'm being candid. So in January of 2020, my wife and I signed a lease on our own building. Yeah. And that was right before COVID hit. So just bad timing and maybe good timing. So that's when we completely branched off on our own, quit our full-time jobs. I'm no longer working for the contract sewing facility. My wife had already quit her mortgage job because we had had our second son at that point. And so she was having to pack and ship every day. And with two kids at home, like it didn't make sense for her to be working. So, and she was working, she was just working at home with kids. So we got our own facility January of 2020. And that's when we basically started. I mean, I had already been running a team at the contract sew shop. So it cut my teeth even more there. Right. Yep. And I come from my dad's background of running a business there. So I've learned a lot over the years. But the struggles, I mean, just hiring staff is very difficult. But even still, we're such a small team still that myself, my wife, a couple of the people wear 10 different hats. And so we didn't have the budget for a marketing guy. So guess what? I'm posted on Instagram. We don't have the budget for a designer. So I would do what I could, or we would outsource small things. And so basically everything, we did as much as we could until we hit the next stage of growth and then tried to hire, you know, we hired a shipping person finally. And that to us was very foreign because my wife and I would ship every single package. And so it was really hard to let go of that. It's really hard to let go of everything, to be honest. And that's something where I probably, if I'm being honest, not the best at maybe being a CEO sometimes, because I want to micromanage. I want to do things my way, but we can't do that anymore. So we are building out our team, and we have 55 employees now in-house in our building that we have, which is very heavily on the manufacturing side. And we're building out the front end side now. Like, we just hired a full-time marketing guy finally. And we're just building out more structure in the business. And that's where it's been hard to do that, but just hiring and firing people and managing them and getting everybody to have the same focus and quality control that you have is very hard to find those people. And we've been very lucky and blessed to find an incredible group of people that we do have, but that's been through a lot of trial and error, to empower them now to go and represent us as if it was myself or my wife represent, you know, no one does represent your business like yourself, but we have a really strong team who's pretty much as good as us as far as they are that proud of what we do here, that they carry themselves in the same manner.
So hiring, firing is an interesting topic. You hear, you know, one side of school will say hire fast, fire slow. Somebody else will say hire slow, fire fast. What's your current philosophy on how to hire? Like, do you spend a ton of time in interviews if it's a more, senior position? And has that changed because of learnings that have happened over the last few years?
It has changed. And our HR, our office manager, she does HR as well. She's taken on more of the hiring. I do more of the bigger roles now, but as far as the production side of things, I've kind of delegated that to my operations manager and our HR manager, just because I can't be doing that and they can handle it anyways. Yep. But that's been tough. And especially during COVID, it was impossible to hire people.
Right.
Because people, A, were staying home, getting paid to stay home. And then B, sewing is a very much a lost art, like any trade is. And people aren't graduating college with a sewing degree. So it's hard to find people to do that. And so it was really hard. I mean, we used to spend a lot more time trying to find sewers. Now, because especially since we've moved bigger building, a little closer to where people, it just kind of starts to snowball. And so, but it very, in the beginning, man, it would be like we would hire 3 sewers, keep 1 long term. It's kind of what it seemed. So it's 2 steps forward, 1 step back, 2 steps forward, 1 step. We're always continually growing, but we go through a lot of different people. I don't think we've let go anybody, especially on the production side, in quite a while. We've had a few people who just, unfortunately, we try to work with everybody as much as we can, but if they keep making the same mistake over and over again, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
So, I'm trying to make sure I hit on all the points of your question, but it's definitely been a process of, I'd say that we're slower to hire quick to hire, slow to fire, I would say, or we have been over time. But now we are way more selective, especially on the production side of things. And even those more intimate roles, because it's really hard to relinquish a lot of those responsibilities to someone. I really want to make sure that they can represent our brand as best as we can. But at the end of the day, a resume can only say so much until you get someone in here and see what their day-to-day work ethic is. It's hard to know.
How do you find the physical location is of where you guys are? Is it a challenge or is it an opportunity? Is it someplace people want to live and there's more people to hire or the other way around?
So Phoenix is laid out like a big square, Phoenix, Arizona. And so we are on the north edge of Phoenix where we're at the intersection of 2 freeways. So we have really good access to us. So it's not like we're 20 miles off the freeway or whatnot in the middle of nowhere. So Phoenix is a massive, city in general. So there is a big labor force there. And there's really, if you go downtown Phoenix, it gets a little bit rougher. But we're also on the north end of Phoenix. So everywhere we live and work around is really nice. But we're kind of at that cusp where if you keep going farther south, it's going to get a little bit rougher. And that's where a lot of manufacturing is. So we're on the far north end of that. Because I also just didn't want to be downtown. I hate traffic. And so I'd say like we're in a pretty desirable location. You keep going farther south, it's going to start getting rougher. You go a little farther north, it gets a little bit out of our price range, which is where we landed up. Where we're at now, because I wanted that happy medium of we want to be in a good location, but it also needs to be affordable.
we love Arizona. I love it for the hunting, and my wife loves it for the weather. And I felt kind of bad because we were in there in February, and you guys, I don't know if you were full blown open at the new spot or not, almost felt bad that I didn't reach out before. Yeah, and it was. Yeah. Probably wasn't the best time to reach out, but I'm not there often. And I was down there watching the Instagram and we were over at the Phoenician and I was like, I should have reached out, man. Cause I had a rental car and I would have loved the opportunity to just pop by and get a walk around. But that for me would be a big draw. Like people love it down there, man. Like the weather is fantastic. Awesome. The hunting is really good. Access to other states is really good. I love the Southwest.
We're surrounded by New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, crazy. Nevada. I mean, Western, we are at this, I want to say epicenter of, Western big game. So you really have quick access to everything. So I love it here. I used to hate it. I would say I hate the heat personally, but it's really nice 8 months out of the year. And then I go somewhere and it's freezing. I'm like, this is why I like Arizona.
Well, I live in Vancouver, man. So we get rained on constantly. So I don't really, and we pick when we go. I think we went in June 1 year and it was a bit much. I like the coos deer hunting in January. To me, that's like perfect Arizona. Nice warm days, cool evenings, like gorgeous.
Oh, you can. I mean, and some podcasting has ruined that, but
yeah,
I mean, you can't beat Arizona in January.
No,
you
just can't. It's amazing. Yeah. Listen, I want to be aware of your time, and there's a bunch of stuff we didn't get to talk on. Maybe we'll do a round two somewhere down the line. Can we hit up some Instagram questions before we close out?
Definitely.
Okay. Awesome. Just let me pull them up. Give me 1 second here.
But yeah, if you're ever in the Phoenix area, I'd love to have you stop by and check out the facility.
I will 100% be back. And I actually drew, I'll be in the neck of the woods. I drew an archery mule deer tag in New Mexico in January. Very cool. Awesome. So I'm very excited. I took my first archery elk in New Mexico in 2019. I drew a really good unit. And so this will be my first time. And I said, no more elk in New Mexico. Cause for me, it's a 36-hour drive. And an elk is so big. It's like, he ain't flying that thing home. You know what I mean? Yeah. So you got to drive. But like from now on, if it's a deer or an owdad, I can go to New Mexico. Cause it'll fit on the plane. The meat will fit on the plane to come home.
Yeah, that's rough. The farthest I've driven is Montana, which is a 20-hour drive from where we were at. And that was a lot.
Yeah, it's a grind, man. BC is so big. I think I've gotten conditioned to it. Like, I got a sheep hunt in August, and that's a 20-hour drive for me, and I won't leave the province. it's 20 hours in that's BC crazy. To get up to where I hunt sheep. Yeah.
That's awesome.
All right, I got to ask this one because it's the one on everybody's mind, and a good buddy threw this out. But what are your thoughts on the new FHF harness and the fact that it bears a shocking resemblance to yours?
I think there's a lot of packs on the market that have a shocking resemblance to our pack now.
Yeah.
It really bothered me. It used to bother me a lot more than it does now. I guess I take it as, you know, what they say, imitation is the highest form of flattery.
Yeah.
They'll take, I will give them a nod more than other companies because I feel like the owner is a really good guy and everything. I've never heard anything bad about him. And I think he genuinely tries to solve problems and he's been doing it longer than I have. But there's a lot of aspects. I mean, I think they've even been candid too and said, oh yeah, we basically took the best features of we thought of every pack and put it into one. So they don't really hide it. And what always drives me nuts is, like, I see is the wings on a pack. Like, we did a really unique way of stitching them with a pleat in there.
Okay.
And everybody copies that now. And so, like, to me, it's like, as soon as I see that, it's like, no one did that before we did. And so, you know, theirs opens different. It uses magnets. It is what it is. You know, they're charging a really high price for it. Good for them if they can get that. And I know there's a ton of labor that goes into it and magnets are super expensive. But we're just gonna keep doing what we're doing, not try to worry about everybody else. And yeah, there's some blatant knockoffs out there. Theirs isn't as, I'm not gonna call it a blatant knockoff, but I mean, they definitely took inspiration from our pack. And it's hard to make anything from scratch nowadays. So it is what it is. And like I said, we're just gonna keep trying to do what we're gonna do and not worry about the other ones. But
I think it's a great attitude, man. And that cost is very prohibitive. I'll be honest with you. I'm in the lineup to do another Bino pack review.
Yeah.
And I'm looking around at which ones I want to include. And I added everything to the cart and like Canadians would be like $400. And I will admit their new harness is pretty interesting. I've heard some negative stuff. Like it might not sit great under the pack.
I
don't know. I haven't run it. So I don't want to
It seems like I feel like the guy puts a lot of time and energy. So I respect that.
Yep.
Right. But yeah, I don't know. It looks like it could be bulky. And not just cause I hear it, people think our harness is too bulky and ours is as low profile as it gets as far as the straps go. And then other people want ours wider. And it's just, you can't please everybody. So there's no one size fits all that's going to make it work for everybody. But yeah, I mean, you start building out that system. It's like we're high end.
It's like $400, man. Like, I have X amount of problems. You saw my Bino review. I have an X amount of problems that I'm trying to solve with my Bino harness.
Yeah.
And by the time I put all the pieces together so that Bino harness solves that suite of problems, you're like in a $400 range or something.
It's a lot. It's a big commitment. I mean, but I think everything that they're doing now, I don't know. Ever since they got bought by Meat Eater, which congrats to them for getting, I guess, you know, that's the goal, I guess, maybe, right? Selling your business. But,
maybe.
Yeah, it's not our goal. I mean, it's not bad. I mean, but Yeah, I don't know. That's
so this is a very interesting, and I've talked about this on a few podcasts. And for people who don't know, the Meat Eater is owned by the Chernin Group, and the Chernin Group owns Barstool Sports, and their entire and Peter Chernin used to be an executive for Viacom, and the entire business model of TCG is find a content creator and build an e-com ecosystem around that. It was Dave Portnoy at Barstool, and now it's Steve Rinella at Meat Eater. Yeah. And they have the exact same MO, and I'm telling you right now, long-term, it ain't good. Like, you are not getting higher quality, better value products out of these guys. Like, it's only going down.
No, everything on social media is just a big sales pitch.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's like we rely on it to make a living, right? But it's... I mean, so what? That Chernin Group buys Meat Eater. Meat Eater buys First Light. Then they buy FHF. Then they buy Phelps. Then they buy... There's another one I just saw.
They just bought the decoys. Davis Decoys. Is it Davis Decoys?
I think Dave Smith.
Dave Smith Decoys. And there's one other one. There's
another one.
Yeah, it's on their site. Because I think they're up to five now.
And they're all like, hey, look at this huge... You know, they all push. It's all on. You can buy it all on one central website. I mean, it's like they got the freaking money to do it. I guess
it's the Walmart of hunting companies, and it's like
they're high end
gear. I felt a little violated because, like, and I know it might be cheesy, but like Rinella was one of the guys that got me into hunting. It was when he went on the Rogan podcast, and it was like my first exposure to backcountry hunting. I was like, oh my God. And you almost feel like a sense of personal ownership of that. And I know I'm not, and he's his own person and he can do whatever he wants, but like, it's got to the point now where it's like, I can't even watch. I had to delete them all off my Instagram. I'm like, you guys just shill products way too hard. I don't have any problem with marketing. Everybody's got to sell. Everybody's got to eat. I get it. But when I open up Instagram and I've got 20 dudes in a row telling me about the new First Light corrugate pants, it's like, guys.
Like watching the news channel where they all have the same script.
Where it pops up all over the place.
Or like every news channel, like every anchor is saying the same thing. So it's like, crazy. Just weird.
It feels a bit gross to me. And it was like, I like to protect my hunting. And it's like, this is a lot of what I talk about on product reviews now. I think we vote with our dollars. And I think the ethos and the people behind a company should be looked at equally as hard as the quality of the product that they're producing. Because if I'm going to give you my money, I'm supporting you. And especially with a product review, if I tell other people to go buy your product, I want to feel comfortable that like you're somebody that I want to support and want to see grow. And I just... I just can't do it with those brands
anymore.
There's
a reason I don't wear a certain camo as much as I do anymore.
Yeah.
And I wear a bunch of hodgepodge camo, but it's, it just feels dirty now. I don't know.
Totally. Okay. Couple more quick ones. Yeah. Challenges competing with companies with bigger financial backing for advertising and R&D.
We're definitely the small fish in the huge ocean of outdoor gear. So what we try to do is just, I feel like when you get massive companies, they get really watered down too, and they have too many people making decisions and it dilutes the brand. So I think because we are still small and in touch, I would say, with the audience more than some other companies, we can make smaller run things too, where these big companies, they're not going to invest in a smaller run type things. I got a production floor out there where I can pivot and make a change right now. And so we can move a lot faster than these other companies can do because we are smaller too. So I think that gives us an advantage. But I'm never gonna have the marketing budget that some of these huge companies do. I mean, even just look, if we're gonna use FHF as a competitor, right?
Yeah.
You got the Chernin Group behind them. I mean, never gonna touch that kind of money. No. So, but what did you just say? You feel like you're getting a sales, you feel like it's inauthentic. What our goal is to always continue to be authentic with our customers. And so that's the market we're going after. I don't need to be the biggest fish out there. We want to be as focused with what we make and make the best product out there with the best warranty and just do that and not worry about the huge company that's trying to take you on. Because I think a lot of people are starting to see through the BS of someone just slapping a logo on anything. So
I think it's a great insight, man. I also think what you've done particularly well is doubled down on your strength, which is your connection with your audience. Mm-hmm. Like, I love the after hours when you walk through and get us the updates on what's being cut for the next day. And it's like, that's where people feel like a sense of connection and ownership. And it's like, yeah, you can't go buy a Super Bowl ad, but that's going to connect more with people.
Yeah. So that's what we try to be as transparent with everything that we do.
Okay. Last one. When will the new radio pouches be out?
We are working on those. We had, I think, every one of them except for foliage. What we did is we had two sizes, and then we decided, hey, let's make one size. It doesn't make sense to have two SKUs. It made the larger radio pouch a little bit bigger. It'll fit a box call a little bit better because people end up using the radio pouch for everything. If they don't go up this week, they should be live on the website next week. That would be beginning of end of May, beginning of June.
Okay, perfect. Anything else you want to mention, man? Any other products? I'm going to include the website address, the Instagram address, but is there anything else you want to share with people who are or listen that you might think be of some value to them?
Just that we got a bunch of new stuff that we're always working on. We are taking a stab at the archery market just because, like I said, I feel like that. I try to always look for avenues that are untapped and something that we can do to make a difference. Everything I've seen in the archery industry, as far as accessory goes, quality is crap. So we're trying to make a splash there. Our enclosed magnetic binocular pack, I still feel is the best pack on the market for how we want it to make packs. We're also coming out with a new non-magnetic pack this fall as well for the people who do not like magnets, and a non-magnetic rangefinder pouch. So that'll be a big addition because we have had people asking for that for years. So those, I'm excited about those packs because we've spent a lot of time working on those. And then our deluxe bow case is coming. My goal is to do a batch of them before the end of the year too, which, like I said, we're trying to disrupt that market. People are going to look at us like we're crazy because we're going to sell an expensive soft case, but it's not going to be for everybody, and it's going to solve a very specific problem. But there's a lot of guys out there who are tired of carrying their expensive bows in a crap soft case. You can't beat a Pelican or a hard SKB case, but who wants to carry around a 40-pound case all the time? So, yeah, that's it. We're trying to constantly just solve problems, improve gear out there, and keep making it here in the U.S., which we're really proud of, and really not cutting any corners with anything that we make.
Well, as I said when we opened, man, I really appreciate you taking the time, because for anybody who follows you on Instagram, it's no secret how busy you guys are. And I love how well you guys are doing, because you are, you know, there's a few companies that I really feel comfortable standing behind. And like, you guys make really great stuff. You make it in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I think you do innovate. And I think that's really important to me, because, you know, as we've touched on a few times, there's opportunities to get away without doing any of that stuff and still make a buck in this industry. And you guys choose not to pursue that avenue. And I really appreciate it. So,
thank you.
Yeah, man, I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. It's a good conversation.
Yeah, man. All right. Have a good one. We'll chat soon.
All right. Sounds good.